Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, baking across the country using vintage cookbooks.
And a social history of underwear.
But first, the State House of Representatives will be back at the Capitol today to talk about the budget. But they won't be debating the spending plan approved by the Senate last week. That's the proposal that had been negotiated with the governor. Instead, the House will be taking up what GOP leaders are calling a continuation budget to get the state through the end of the fiscal year next Monday, until lawmakers can come to an agreement on a full budget. This follows the House having approved a spending plan along party lines that Governor Hobbs had declared dead on arrival. The Senate then okayed its bipartisan proposal, but House Speaker Steve Montenegro announced on Friday that that plan did not have enough votes to pass among his members. With me, as he is every Monday during the legislative session, is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. And Howie, it doesn't seem like where we are was necessarily part of the plan.
Well, it's hard to say what's part of the plan because this is a legislature that's known for kind of operating by the seat of its pants. It certainly wasn't part of what the Senate thought was going to happen a week ago. They thought, look, we have a deal with the governor. Republicans are willing to go along, at least a majority of the Senate Republicans, a majority of the Senate Democrats, and the governor. They said, we've been trying to negotiate with the House. The House sort of stepped away at some point and said, we're going to go our own way. But they figured there are votes in the House. I mean, even David Livingston, who chairs the House Appropriations Committee, told me, oh, probably a week ago, there are enough votes here to get this bill out. There are the 31 votes in the 60-member chamber. Well, I think part of what happened was when the Senate said, we're done with the budget, is they made a motion to adjourn sine die, which means the session is over. And that sent a message to the House and to the House Speaker, Steve Montenegro, that this was a take it or leave it budget. And they got a little ticked off and they said, no, this is not going to happen this way. And so they are due back this morning to introduce what they call a continuation budget. The idea being we just keep the state running because otherwise if there's no budget, state shuts down July 1st. And then we will continue to negotiate because somehow whatever we weren't able to get in January, February, March, April, May, or this month, we'll be able to get in July.
Well, and Howie, interestingly, Speaker Montenegro referenced the idea of a take-it-or-leave-it budget, not liking that idea in a statement that he put out, I believe, late Friday. Now, you have been covering the Capitol for a minute or two. Has this happened before, that there's been a continuation budget?
There has never been. We actually had one year where we did get into July 1st.
Yeah.
And what happened is everyone knew that there was a budget coming. So they kind of squinted and said, oh no, it's not July 1st. These aren't the droids you're looking for, so to speak. And everything stayed open. But I have never seen a contingency budget. I mean, I've been covering this place since 82, been in Arizona now since the early 70s. Obviously, I don't go back to George W. P. Hunt, who was Arizona's first governor, so I cannot tell you what happened there. But I've never heard of this in Arizona. Now, this is not unusual at the federal level.
Right.
Because working with, 535 people in Washington is a whole different thing. And so they'll pass a continuation budget before September 30th, which is the end of the federal fiscal year, and they'll keep talking. There is no provision for that in the Arizona Constitution to just keep working. You can't just say, whatever we were doing, we're going to keep doing. That gets to the question of what the continuation budget look like. I mean, last year's budget was somewhere in the neighborhood of $16.2 billion compared to the $17.6 that's in the budget that was the Senate passed, or even the $17.3 that the House passed. Do we just go back to what we were doing? What about inflation? What about state aid to schools, which is adjusted every year? What about the Arizona healthcare cost containment system? Are we adjusting for more people going in? This is uncharted territory.
Well, Howie, there's also the issue of Governor Hobbs saying that she would not sign a continuation budget. So, how does that work into all this?
We're in the game of chicken mode here. I mean, it was more than I won't sign it. It was sort of telling the House Speaker, Steve Montenegro, exactly where he could stick his continuation budget. And so we don't know. Is somebody going to blink? I would assume so, based on prior history. Somebody has always blinked. I don't know whether maybe they could take the Senate budget and do a few tweaks in there. Part of what the problem is, this isn't just about money. The House has a bunch of other things in there that they want, House Republicans, that is, you know, having to do with one measure that would make it harder for Attorney General Chris Mace to do political prosecutions. They've got some things in there about a 2.5% cut in tuition at the state universities for in-state students, but they're not making it up with the general fund. It's not like we'll increase state aid. And so it's the policy stuff that the governor said, look, let's not do any policy stuff, and I will sign off on some of your expenditure priorities, even some of the pork that's in the budget on both sides. You know, you've got folks, you know, there are some things that are going in for traffic circles, for example. And there are some broader projects, for example, widening Interstate 10 west from Citrus out to State Route 85.
Yeah.
And so she was willing to go along with some of them. And she said, let's just keep the policy stuff out. So this is about more than money.
Well, so Howie, what has the Senate said, if anything, about this? They're the ones who approved a budget that had been negotiated with the governor. Does it seem as though the Senate might be on board with a continuation budget?
Well, again, it depends on who you ask and when you ask them. Originally, Senate President Warren Peterson said, look, this isn't the game. You know, this isn't like, you know, we're playing The Price is Right here. We passed out a budget. It is a decent budget. It is a realistic budget. Senator John Kavanaugh, heads of Senate Appropriations Committee, said, you know, just recognize, you know, that there's divided government. That's just the way this thing has to work. Now, what's interesting is after the House Speaker said, well, we're going to put out our own budget, he said, look, I still think we've got a good budget, but we will come back and we will take a look at what you put out. So even he's a little on the soft side. And some of this comes down to what they call the Freedom Caucus. They're the most conservative, fiscally conservative members of the legislature, and how they could try to tear things apart because they know that there aren't enough Democrats by themselves to put the thing out, even if you add a few Republicans, because there's some Democrats like Priya Sundaresan who said, I can't vote for this because it is give me enough money, but I will go ahead and say my caucus should support it to get us to the votes we need. So again, uncharted. We're just going to be, you know, doing this, and we may be sitting here next Monday morning at 9:06 a.m. and saying, ruh-roh, because next Monday is June 30th, and we're starting to run out of hours.
Yeah, Howie's going to ask you about that quickly before we wrap up. 1 week from today at midnight, the fiscal year ends. And as you alluded, like, we don't really know what happens if there's no budget. And it doesn't look like they're going to be passing one, you know, within a few hours of the clock striking midnight.
I think that's the great unknown, because the other piece of this is there's an assumption that essential services will continue. The prisons are not going to open their doors. We know that. What else is considered essential? Is DPS essential? What about Department of Revenue, which processes money coming in that you need? Will they go away? Will they be told to stay home? Or will they do perhaps where they say, look, we'll continue working under the assumption that we will backfill in our salaries later, even though there's no legal authority for them to be there? All of this is a great unknown.
Right. All right. Lots to keep our eyes on this week, as always. Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Looks like you've got an exciting week ahead of you. Thank you.
Keep your fingers crossed.
COVID variants are back in the news as a fresh strain of the virus is on the rise in the Eastern Mediterranean, Southeast Asia, and Western Pacific regions of the world. Joining us now to tell us what to keep an eye on is Arizona Public Health Association Executive Director Will Humble. Good morning, Will.
Morning. Thanks for the invitation.
Thank you for being here. Let's start out very high level. Some people may have heard this very terrifying nickname for the variant, razor blade throat. How does this version of COVID compare to previous strains?
I knew this term was going to take off when my 28-year-old daughter asked me, "What, Dad, what's this razor blade virus?" And I'm like, okay, they use that word. I know that's going to go viral. But the bottom line is,
as it were.
Yeah. You talked about the big picture here, which is the COVID virus started off as a lower respiratory virus. That was what was so dangerous about it, is that it caused a lot of pneumonia, and that's what killed people for the most part. As it evolved, and especially as Omicron came on the scene, as the Omicron variant, it became an upper respiratory system and up in the neck and throat. And so this newest version of an Omicron virus, this is still Omicron, it presents itself clinically often as a really bad sore throat, or let me just say a sore throat. That's essentially like what's going on here, is that the virus keeps trying to stay ahead of human immune systems so that it can continue to survive as a virus by infecting people and spreading.
But if I'm clocking that correctly, obviously razor blade throat sounds very uncomfortable, but the lethality level is decreasing.
Right. Give me a choice between a sore throat and a pneumonia.
Yes.
I'll take sore throat every day of the week.
Okay. So let's say people are hearing about this and they've already gotten a COVID vaccine. Is there any concern there? If their vaccines are up to date, should they be worried about this strain of the virus?
Not in the way you're talking about it.
Oh,
they should be concerned about being able to have access to the vaccines in the future. And maybe we'll have time to get into that.
Yes.
But in terms of clinical, this isn't any worse.
Okay.
There's no worse clinical presentation in terms of lethality or bad outcomes. It's encouraging that it continues to migrate towards an upper respiratory rather than lower respiratory virus.
Okay. Well, let's talk about what you're alluding to there. This is, of course, happening in the wake of the news that Secretary of Health and Human Services Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has replaced previous members of the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. You wrote a blog post about this recently concerning these changes, and you're concerned, right?
Oh, yeah, big time.
Yeah, perhaps not a strong enough word.
Yeah, I mean, the new members of the—so there were 17 members of the former committee that were vetted based on their expertise, their depth of knowledge with vaccine practice, the ability to critique studies and look at clinical trials to sort of discern the details. And they've been replaced by and large with eight people, well, six of the eight people on the new committee. So Kennedy got rid of all 17 of the former committee. He put eight people on, and six of those eight are just well-known anti-vaccine people.
And what implications does that have, as you were talking about, for the availability of the vaccines going forward?
So just sticking with COVID for a second, Secretary Kennedy's already said that for the upcoming influenza season, people over 65 will be able to continue to get the vaccine and have either Medicare or their health plan pay for that. But kids and pregnant women no longer would be able to get the vaccine. They could still get the vaccine if they can find someone to give it to them, but it will cost them $220. And then this week is probably what we're going to see from that new committee I just described, is a decision to move the vaccine to a different category, meaning that for people under 60, everyone under 65, that basically are most likely by this time next week, you'd be expected to pay full freight, and your health plan probably won't cover it. Now, your health plan still can decide to cover it, but they're no longer required to cover it after ACIP and the CDC dropped their recommendation, which hasn't happened yet for everyone under 65, but I think by Friday it will be.
So you're saying that seems to be the likely outcome of those conversations this week?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of us in public health have been worried about what Mr. Kennedy is going to do for vaccinations. And initially, my reaction was I thought, oh, maybe he's going to just get the FDA to pull the licenses of these vaccines. And no, that's not his MO. That's not his strategy. What he's doing is taking vaccines off the recommended list. Therefore, health plans not covering that vaccine, thereby lowering immunization rates. But he can't get sued by the vaccine manufacturers because he didn't pull their license.
Right. He just made them much harder to get unless you're able to pay out of pocket.
Bingo.
All right. Well, lots to keep an eye on there. Will Humble is the executive director of the Arizona Public Health Association. Thank you, Will.
My pleasure.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, would you try Kool-Aid pie? How do you feel about 7-Up Jell-O salad? Why one cookbook author collects and tries out vintage recipes.
But first, as you've been hearing all weekend and into this morning, the U.S. entered the conflict between Israel and Tehran over the weekend, and tensions are running high. Joining us with the latest on this and some other international stories is the BBC's Rob Hugh Jones. Rob, what are you hearing?
Yes, so the latest is that Israel has launched an intense new wave of strikes on Tehran. That's the Iranian capital, of course. And it says it's targeting agencies of government repression. So the Israeli defense minister said Tehran's been hit with unprecedented force, to use his words. The damage sites include Evin prison, which holds political detainees, and also a paramilitary organization in Tehran, often deployed to stamp out dissent in Iran. Now, why is are the Israelis doing a thing like that? Well, you might argue that their interest is not just in destroying these facilities that the US was involved in, but also in regime change in Iran. That is their ultimate goal, certainly for Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister. So this would explain why they've picked out some of these targets today. We've seen some Iranian missiles going the other way. A number of those have avoided Israeli air defenses. So, for example, an industrial area near a power station in Ashdod in Israel was struck, although we've not heard any casualty figures there. Meanwhile, we've had the Iranian foreign minister went to Moscow. That was the first thing he did, really, after these attacks. There is a strong relationship between Russia and Iran. Vladimir Putin called the American attacks absolutely unprovoked aggression. That was his expression. But our Russia editor says that even though Russia and Iran are allied, it's unlikely that there will be any military assistance coming from Moscow for Iran. They don't have a defense pact. They have a strategic pact. A lot going on in this story. It really does change kind of hour by hour. And that's the latest that we're seeing at the moment.
Well, against this backdrop, Rob, this coming week in the Netherlands will be the latest NATO summit. And high on the agenda, obviously, the Iran situation. But so, too, the latest on the Russia-Ukraine war. Tell us more.
Yeah, so this is a NATO summit in The Hague in the Netherlands. It's being hosted by Mark Rutte, who is the NATO chief, but he's also a former prime minister of the Netherlands, so he's on home turf. Their original priority, and priority number one, was to talk about defense spending. What he wants, Mr. Rutte, is to ask all 32 members of NATO to contribute 5% of their GDP to defense. Something that Donald Trump would be very happy with. He, of course, has been urging European and NATO allies just to do exactly that. So Mr. Rutte is, you know, using tones that would be appreciated by the White House. Interestingly, they're not talking about 5% on defense in every country. They're talking about potentially 3.5% as a target and then 1.5% on, quote, infrastructure or defense infrastructure, which is a bit of a wider sort of catch-all for anything in the defense industry. So we'll see what happens there. In the meanwhile, Mark Rutte has just given a press conference in the last hour or two, and he's rejected the idea that support for Ukraine will be put on the back burner at this NATO summit beginning this week because of Iran. He said allies had not lost sight of events in Ukraine, pointing to the fact that they'd promised Kiev $35 billion in aid already this year, which is a higher figure compared with a similar period last year. Mr. Rutte also called continued Russian attacks on Ukraine abhorrent. The latest Russian attack today on Kiev killed at least 9 people in a residential block, including an 11-year-old girl. There's also been a missile attack on a school in the Odessa region in the south on the Black Sea, in which 2 people died. President Volodymyr Zelensky, the Ukrainian leader, called that strike absolutely insane. And although the 32 members of NATO gathering in the Netherlands will certainly be discussing the Middle East, they're not forgetting Russia, Ukraine. So we'll see quite a lot of that this week as well.
Yes, of course. Well, let's pivot, if we could, Rob, to less militaristic developments. Let's move to wedding news. Venice this week will play host to one of the most high-profile weddings of the year when Amazon founder Jeff Bezos and Lauren Sanchez tie the knot. Lots of glitz and glamour around this to come.
Lots of glitz and glamour. So Bezos's $500 million sailing yacht, Coru, will be anchored in the Venetian Lagoon. There are some 200 guests invited to this wedding. Apparently, all the luxury hotels in Venice are sold out with the guests and their families and their entourages and so on. I've seen notes from local shopkeepers who are delighted because they think the tourist trade doesn't spend enough money in Venice, even though there are loads and loads of tourists going there. So they are hoping for a kind of payday. But I should say it's not doesn't suit everyone. And in fact, there are activists who say, we don't like this. We don't like the way Venice is being used as a kind of stage for the rich and famous around the world to come and do these things like this. And so they're actually looking, some of them are actually looking to try and cause some trouble here, like, you know, jumping into the canals and barricading some of the narrower streets to stop guests from getting to the wedding venue and all that sort of thing. Whether that transpires or not, let's see, because the mayor is in favor. Lots of shopkeepers, as I say, are in favor, but some local people are not. So we'll see what happens. But certainly lots of glitz and glamour in Venice this coming week, for sure.
All right. Well, some meaningful balance there for the heavier issues going on around the world.
Indeed.
That is the BBC's Rob Hugh-Jones keeping us in the loop, as always. Rob, thank you very much.
Yes, thanks so much.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. There are some things about modern life that many of us probably tend to take for granted, things that are designed to make us comfortable. Air conditioning, upholstery, sunglasses. But when we do stop for a second to consider the origins of these things, it's usually not long before we have to reckon with class. And that is definitely the case for one of those things we all rely on but really don't like to think about, underwear. Well, ASU professor Kelly Hawkinson has spent a lot of time thinking about underwear. She is a trained costume designer, and she says that the garments we conceal under our clothes were once considered a great luxury.
Around the 13th or 14th century, we start to see trends that start with the aristocracy and move downward. So the initial early women's underwear, you always kind of started with a layer that would protect your body's oils, sweat, whatever, from the garment itself. So there was always some sort of chemise. And then as we move forward, we want a little bit more structure. You know, we gain more technology when it comes to cutting things. And one of the first things we start to see is a stiffened bodice. So around the early 16th century, we decide to separate the bodice from the skirt. So this gives us many more options when it comes to tailoring, and we start making choices that are beyond just practicality.
That's very interesting to me what you said about how early versions of underwear, part of the design thinking was absorption to, like, prevent the clothes themselves from being soiled. Is that because it was a bigger deal to wash things?
Fabric was very expensive. So you think about what it takes to make fabric in pre-industrial society. I have to go out and I have to feed that sheep until it gets big enough to, like, grow its wool, or I've got to grow linen, which takes, like, you know, 7 months, and then process it into fiber, and then weave it into something that is fabric, all basically by hand. Fabric was precious, and you can't necessarily wash wool regularly because it'll shrink. So you want something next to your body that you can wash every day. And that's where things like what is known as the chemise, which is a long dress, and it was worn by women. And then men had some sort of undershirt that did the same kind of thing. And oftentimes it was long enough that they could wrap it around themselves below their pants, you know, like so it could kind of envelope their undercarriage. Because, yes, it was more difficult to wash things and kind of not practical. You didn't have a lot of clothes.
Right.
You know?
So at a certain point, the visual presentation of the underwear itself becomes something that people are thinking about.
Well, think of it as architecture. So let's take Tudor England. So Catherine of Aragon is known for bringing the Spanish farthingale to England. And what it was made of bent pieces of wood, and it kept the skirts out in sort of an A shape. But it's a chance to really, like, turn what we thought was just, like, something practical, something that's about collecting sweat, into an article of fashion. And actually a chance to really engineer something. Like, you know, there's a lot of, like, showing status, you know, having a garment that takes up space to say, look, I'm in charge here, you know?
Right.
Think Queen Elizabeth I in this big round dress. And, you know, the idea of taking up physical space via the undergarments became important, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It keeps people away from her. You know, it's a way to show off your wealth because it takes a lot of fabric to cover that kind of ground, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like soft power, you know?
When do the briefs and... you know, what probably most people listening to this are picturing when they think of underwear.
Yeah.
When do those start to appear?
Shockingly late.
Okay.
Listen, the men's Y-front brief, 1935. That's when that was introduced on the scene.
Less than 100 years ago.
Yes, exactly. Women didn't wear panties, as we know it, until the 30s regularly. Before that, it was like little pantaloons, like in the 20s, so like little shorts.
Okay.
They were like, you know, knickers, that kind of thing. But women didn't even wear underwear under those skirts, like the bigger skirts that we see in Elizabethan times during the 18th century. No underwear. Why? Because you had all this skirt. So
it's a lot of
if
fabric
you had to
happening.
Use the restroom, you can't take that off. So your best bet was you had some sort of crotchless drawers, and then you would just stand over wherever you had to use the restroom. You know, that's practical.
Something I have always been curious about in men's underwear is I remember the horrific experience of having to change in the locker room during gym class when I was in school, and that there was this real point where it switched over and it was no longer cool to wear briefs. You were supposed to wear boxers. What was that about? Like, what is the boxer brief divide? Where does that come from?
So boxers were first worn in the military. So they were issued to soldiers in World War II.
Okay.
And then part of what made them popular is that the soldiers came home and they're like, these are great, you know. And then we started to see more patterns and prints. And it's interesting, like in the 90s, what you're talking about, that was the rise of Calvin Klein. And like all of a sudden we got somebody, I mean, Calvin Klein was the first one to put his name on underpants. And people wanted to show that off as, again, a form of status.
Uh-huh.
So I think that those trends just ebb and flow and will continue.
Well, since you brought up Calvin Klein, when does underwear go from being a practical item that you're using just to have something on under your clothes to something that is being advertised, something that is a fashion statement to wear?
It's well, to be honest, I think it started in gay culture, that you started to see more magazines that were targeted at fashion for gay men, that you would see colored underwear and different things. But Calvin Klein, that series of posters of that those ads really changed, like made underwear a fashion statement. And he set a trend, like now you see it everywhere. I mean, when you look at Edwardian underwear, so this is the Gilded Age, you know, and we have these frothy confections of petticoats that have like lace upon tuck. And no one's supposed to see that, you know, but it's, again, this is a time where the country has money or the world is wealthier, you know, people can afford more, plus we can mechanize more things.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it's just, why not? Why not think about every detail? We make choices in our personal dress about how we want to see ourselves and how we want our world to see ourselves. And so you can make an argument that that absolutely comes down to the first thing you put on in the morning, which is your underwear.
Well, Kelly Hawkinson is a costume designer and clinical assistant professor at the School of Music, Dance, and Theater at the Herberger Institute at ASU. Kelly, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Friday marked the 50th anniversary of the opening of the movie Jaws, which was, of course, directed by Phoenix's own Steven Spielberg. The film made more than $477 million worldwide and is widely recognized as the first summer blockbuster. But before Spielberg was filming in the waters off Martha's Vineyard, he was shooting in the valley. Phil Boas, opinion columnist with the Arizona Republic, has written about this and joins me to talk about it. And Phil, this anniversary seems like a pretty significant moment for a pretty famous Phoenix native.
Well, it is. I mean, this is one of the very best stories in the history of Arizona. If you love Arizona and you care about this place and you enjoy the history of Arizona, this is our best story. And it is a story of a boy who grew up sort of on sort of an outsider, kind of pushed aside, sometimes teased by the kids. And he used a little 8mm camera to go out and make movies and to teach himself how to become a director, self-taught. And he would grow up to become the most successful motion picture director in the history of movies, bar none. There's nobody who matches his success as a filmmaker. And he did it all over our city, all over our town, you know, places like Sky Harbor One. He was filming at Papago Park. He was filming at the base of Camelback Mountain, little war films. And one of the things that I've always tried to press is every time we look at Camelback Mountain, we should think to ourselves, that's the place where a kid named Steven Spielberg taught himself how to make movies.
So let's talk specifically about Jaws, which, of course, very recently celebrated its 50th anniversary. And, you know, when you talk about Steven Spielberg filming at Sky Harbor and filming at Camelback Mountain, you know, that's one thing. But it seems like it was kind of a risk, and you wrote about this, to have a kid from the desert direct a movie about a shark in the ocean.
Well, so Spielberg he didn't start out in motion pictures. He started out in television, you know, his first gigs in Hollywood. So he was making the Columbo series. He was doing some of that. And he also made a motion picture for TV called Duel. And it was about how a truck driver, unseen throughout the whole movie, is stalking this businessman in his little red car. And Spielberg used to call it, Jaws on Wheels. But when the Jaws property became available, they were thinking about that film that Spielberg had made it and what he had done with that and the suspense he had built, and thought that he might be good for this movie about a shark. He had also gotten some tremendous reviews, one in particular from the dean of film critics, maybe the greatest film critic in history, Pauline Kael, saw Spielberg's first feature motion picture for the big screen, The Sugar Land Express, and said, you know, this is just a tremendous piece of work by a young filmmaker. And that really launched his career after that. So they gave him this assignment to make Jaws one of the most anticipated motion pictures, because it was preceded by a best-selling novel that just scared the bejesus out of everybody who read it. All of us kids had that book. It was dog-eared, and we you know, the sharks were on the mind. And I tell my kids, you cannot know what it was like back then, because we had no understanding of sharks. They were very mysterious. And to have that book and then movie, it just scared us to death.
Well, so yeah, Phil, I want to ask you, because for those of us who were not around 50 years ago, like, what was it like, the anticipation of this movie coming out, waiting in lines, and then seeing it? And like, at that time, did you know that it was going to still be such a relevant, important movie 5 decades later?
No, in fact, the movie has grown in importance because I think it's the appreciation for the skill to make that movie has grown by the year. And so it has held up really well and probably grows stronger in reputation by the year. But I can remember being back at the theater in Arizona. First time I saw it was at Christown Mall. And I've known I have friends who saw it there too for the first time. And we remember the long lines,
Yeah. Everybody
waiting to get in. And remember, because this had been the best-selling novel, you know, there were great expectations that the movie was going to meet the power of the novel. So there was a lot of pressure on Spielberg to do that. They gave this assignment to a 27-year-old kid from Arizona, and he had to go out to Martha's Vineyard and on location try to make this movie on the ocean, you know, with a mechanical shark. They have three versions of this mechanical shark. Well, they were not appreciating nor understanding how difficult it is to make a movie trying to match the light and shadow and the background on the sea from shot to shot to shot. It's incredibly difficult to do. And so things got bogged down, the expenses went up, and the suits from Universal Studios in Hollywood flew out to Martha's Vineyard to find out what the heck's going on with our picture. You know, why is it bogged down? And Spielberg, as a kid, had to walk them off the ledge, walk them back, and reassure them that he was going to deliver this picture and that it was going to be a smash. And in fact, he did that. And so at 27, Steven Spielberg made the most successful picture in the history of movies, the biggest grossing box office in history at that time, beating The Godfather.
At that time, was there a sense of pride here in Arizona that a local kid had made this movie?
Arizonans scarcely know this story. A few years back, I went from, you know, Valley community to Valley community, just telling this story with a PowerPoint, and people were blown away that this happened in their backyard. You know, that Spielberg had done so much while he lived here. He made his first full-length motion picture in 16 millimeter as a kid. And in 1964, they premiered it at Phoenix Little Theater. And it was called Firelight. And it was really the beginnings of what would later become Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And the word used commonly is transmogrified. He reshaped that childhood picture into what became a sci-fi classic.
Interesting. All right, we'll have to leave it there. Phil Boas, opinion columnist with the Arizona Republic. Phil, I think we're going to need a bigger boat. Thank you.
You bet.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Have you ever wondered what America's past tastes like? B. Dylan Hollis has turned that curiosity into a social media phenomenon. His TikTok videos show him baking and then trying dishes like water pie, 7-Up Jell-O salad, and potato donuts. Hollis has also written two cookbooks. The second is called Baking Across America, A Vintage Recipe Road Trip. He'll be at Changing Hands Bookstore in Tempe tonight to talk about it. He joins me, and let's start with how you go about finding all these vintage recipes.
Well, you know, I had always been a collector of old things, so I collected old vacuum tube radios, I collected old records and books, and, you know, my daily driver is on the front of this cookbook, Baking Across America, is my 1963 Cadillac. I called him Ernest after country musician Ernest Tubb. And when the pandemic rolled around, you know, I was looking for recipe ideas. I had never really baked before. So I started looking for video ideas, and I was going through my old collections, and I came across this old 1915 Five Roses Flour cookbook, and in there it had a recipe for a pork cake. Yeah, which is just a fruit cake with a pound of ground pork in there. And that was my first sort of cookbook experience. And I said, look, the internet needs to find out about this. I want to show them that this is a real recipe in print. And I baked that online, and the response was immediate, and it was heavy, and people really were interested in this. So, circle back to your question. Folks started sending me in these cookbooks.
Wow.
They would mail them to me to my post office box during, 2020, 2021. And I even got a few calls from my post office saying, "Hey, you've got too many books here. Can you please come and pick them up, Mr. Hollis?" So, what started as just, perusing antique stores and estate sales, they then began to come to me, and it was a hard time. I now have a bit of a library of old cookbooks in my house.
What appeals to you so much about old things?
There's a certain weight, a certain power to them that you can pick up and interact with things that were created 100, 60, 70 years ago. And you can sort of imagine yourself interacting in the same manner that the folks who were interacting with them when they were around first. You get that sort of connection. And with recipes specifically, the fact that you can time travel really poignantly. I mean, you can take a look at an old photograph or an old movie, and you can kind of see the sights and get the gist. But with an old recipe, with an old cookbook, not only can you pick it up and feel something directly from 1930, but you can then recreate that recipe, bake it, and then taste it just the same as it was 100 years ago. And that's a very powerful thing to me. And it's really exciting to be able to do that because it's a direct sort of path to history. It's a doorway that you open up.
Well, it sounds like, in some cases, you might not be able to, watch a video of what something looked like at the turn of the 20th century, but you can taste what that time period tasted like.
Yes, and sometimes that's for the better. And sometimes it's not. Think of the 1920s, right there in 1929, the bottom fell out
Yep.
from a lot of countries' economies, and they had to make do with what they had. So during, I think of a 1929 recipe from up in Canada, for example. It's called pudding chômeur. Basically, translates to an unemployed pudding. So it was just a combination of real pantry ingredients, flavored by maple syrup, but people still wanted dessert, and during a time of difficulty. And that's the really cool thing about, bringing together what you got to put something fun on the table.
Well, it sounds like you have come across some recipes that maybe would have been better off left in the past.
Yeah, I do. I think of the pork cake, of course, that I
Yeah.
mentioned to you. Everyone can get a hold of butter and fats and lard, and you don't have to approximate anymore by adding in a pound of fatty pork.
What stands out to you about maybe things that you have learned about history by doing this? I mean, you mentioned, sort of Depression era recipes are kind of what you have and what you could get and maybe what you could afford. Are there other things that you have sort of picked up about history by doing this?
Yeah, you find dialogue and commentary on things, and sometimes it's a matter of status. I think of when refrigeration first came on the scene. 1920s, 1930s, it really started to enter the American household, but it was still a very expensive thing. So to have a refrigerator was very special. So you would start seeing these recipes that incorporated gelatin and gelatin molds because they did require refrigeration. So to be served one of these things at a dinner party at your, your neighborhood friend's house, perhaps you didn't venture into the kitchen, but if that came out, on your table, then you started saying, "Ooh, this person is rather affluent." So the deluge of these gelatin recipes started sort of as a status symbol. So yeah, recipes like that, they can be approached from a different angle, the angle of trying to impress.
Yeah. So let me ask you about a recipe from this neck of the woods, prickly pear cheesecake. And I have to tell you that while some of the recipes that you've dealt with sound truly disgusting, this one sounds actually really very tasty.
Yes, and I have to mention that, of course, in my cookbooks, most of that which I put in there is, of course, very good.
Sure.
And Yeah, down in Arizona. Now, we've got three recipes that I featured in Baking Across America for Arizona. And the prickly pear cheesecake is on the more touristy side. When we think of the classic bakes and the classic flavors from states, some flavors aren't so much of a state of Arizona, but sort of thrust upon it. Now, there are prickly pear, there's plenty of prickly pear cacti in Arizona, but you're not out eating it every day, are you?
No, we're not.
But it is very good. And when you go to any sort of tourist spot, you go to like Saguaro National Park, you go to the gift store, you're going to find prickly pear X, Y, and Z. And of course, that's on the surface, but it's also very good. So prickly pear as a flavoring in desserts and baked goods, it's a great note. And I really wanted to apply that to a cheesecake. And there were a few prickly pear cheesecakes in my old cookbooks. And I sort of lay them out, all of the prickly pear recipes from community cookbooks from Arizona from 1960s all the way up to 1990s. And I bake them all and I say, okay, this is what this one did well, this is what this one didn't. And you come out with a distilled, really great recipe for, prickly pear cheesecake.
That is B. Dylan Hollis. He is the author of Baking Across America, a Vintage Recipe Road Trip. Thank you so much. This was a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
Thank you kindly.
Sam, am I right to understand you have had a potato donut?
I certainly have in Portland, Maine.
How was it?
It was delicious. It's more of a savory donut, perhaps unsurprisingly, but very frosting forward.
Okay, frosting forward. I love it. All right. Well, on that tasty note, that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for being along. For Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.